From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now as congressional leaders move toward a deal to give small businesses hundreds of billions of dollars more in emergency funding. The state of Georgia is preparing to reopen some businesses against the wishes of mayors and health experts. We'll go to Atlanta in a moment.
But first, we start this hour in the nation's second largest city, Los Angeles, where we're learning more about the extent of the spread of the coronavirus. A preliminary antibody study at the University of Southern California and the LA County Department of Health found that anywhere from 200,000 to 400,000 adults in Los Angeles County may have been infected and have already recovered. That's far more than the 8,000 initially confirmed cases. These findings come as cities and states throughout the country weigh whether to lift stay-at-home orders. For more, we have the study's leader, Niraj Sood. He is professor and senior fellow at USC's Price School of Public Policy. Welcome.
Thank you.
So these numbers, which account for a margin of error, are somewhat astounding because it shows the virus may be more widespread than we thought. But you want to caution that this is not an indication of herd immunity. Can you please say more?
Sure. So what we find is that about 4% of adults in Los Angeles County have had a COVID infection. Most experts think that you achieve, or a population achieves, herd immunity at somewhere at 60% infection rate. So we are very far away from 60%. Which means we are likely to see many more infections and hospitalizations and deaths as the number of infections rises.
There's been some criticism of these kinds of antibody studies. Some are calling them junk science. How was your study conducted and what is the margin of error?
So the way the study was conducted was we got a market research firm to randomly select some individuals from proprietary databases that they own. Then these individuals were invited to participate in the study. We set quotas for different demographic groups so that eventually our study participants, based on gender, age, and so on, look similar to the distribution in LA County as a whole. And then we set up 6 drive-through testing sites across LA County, and we tested them. And as we noted that, you know, the findings of the study are preliminary. As the study goes through peer review, we might change our methods on the way in which we estimate the margin of error or account for other factors that might influence our estimates.
There's also concern about false positives. Is that a concern for you and your team?
That is a concern for us and our team. And there is the flip side of it, which is there is also a concern about false negatives. And what we do is we account for both false positives and false negatives. So the critics of the study have just tried to focus on the false positives and argue that the infection rate we report might be higher because some of them might be false positives. But the flip side of this is that these tests are still new. And in fact, their false negative rate is way higher than their false positive rate. So there are these two competing effects, and our statistical methods or mathematical models do try to account for them. And in addition, we say that as we get more information about these tests, we can update the results based on new information about the false positive or the false negative rates of the test.
You know, there are really two ways to think of these findings. As you've laid out here, it shows that the mortality rate of this disease is lower than expected. But also, there are more people who may have it, which in that turn puts more people in vulnerable populations at risk. I'm just thinking about as cities and states throughout the country make decisions on whether to lift these stay-at-home orders, you're emphasizing that these initial findings really should not make people dismiss the risks of COVID-19.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is what we need to do is take these initial findings, put them in these disease prediction models, and then make better predictions about the burden of disease as the number of infections rise, and then use those models to make public policy decisions. And public policy decisions should not only focus on COVID-related outcomes, but look at other aspects. This is a multifaceted problem. Let's make those decisions based on the best possible evidence and let's look at the problem more holistically.
Dr. Sood is professor and senior fellow at USC's Price School of Public Policy. Doctor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, now to Georgia, where a number of businesses are preparing to open on Friday after Governor Brian Kemp's announcement yesterday.
We will allow gyms, fitness centers, bowling alleys, body art studios, barbers, cosmetologists, hair designers, nail care artists, estheticians, their respective schools, and massage therapists to reopen their doors this Friday.
That announcement brought swift backlash from health officials and mayors who worry about reopening too soon. Stephen Fowler is with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, first of all, explain more about what this order does and what precautions these businesses are going to have to take.
Well, Jeremy, this isn't reopening business as usual for these different organizations. It allows some of them to do minimum basic operations, which means they can go back into the office, do payroll things, administrative things, as long as they follow about 20 different guidelines like sanitizing things, employees wearing masks, keeping people at least 6 feet away. So in a lot of these cases, there's not going to really be the opportunity for people to flood hair salons and everyone to go, you know, play a couple rounds of bowling. And so there's a lot of precautions businesses have to take. These precautions are what other businesses in Georgia, not considered critical infrastructure, have been under since the beginning of April when Georgia was sheltered in place.
Still a lot of people not happy about this, a lot of mayors not happy about this because this order overrides any local orders. What are critics saying?
Well, you know, the mayors were not consulted before this decision was made. In the hours after Kemp gave the press conference, you had the mayors of Atlanta and Augusta and Albany and Savannah and Tybee Island all going on different national outlets expressing their concern over their ability to do what's best for their citizens. The mayor of Albany, which is one of the hardest hit spots in the country, said there's still a lot of people on ventilators. There's still new deaths. And he does not think that his area is ready to reopen and hopes that people still stay home.
And just briefly, Stephen, do you think people in Georgia are going to feel safe enough to go to any of these businesses if they open?
Well, I know in my neighborhood, there's a new restaurant that opened up about 6 months ago, and they said they're not having people come in because they don't think it's safe for employees or their customers to be able to open up. Mm-hmm. So I think, if anything, there's a slow reopening.
That is reporter Stephen Fowler at Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Each of the 42,000 plus COVID-19 deaths recorded so far in the U.S. has a life attached to it, and often many grieving family members and friends. I found out a little over a week ago that a friend from college, Daryl Dushner, lost his mom to the disease. She was 72-year-old Annette Dushner of Valley Stream, New York. I asked Daryl to join me to talk about her and what he's been going through. Daryl, thanks for being here, and I am so, so sorry about your mom.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy, and very much appreciate your condolences.
How are you holding up, first of all?
It's tough. You can't really have human contact as we're isolating, and aside from my girlfriend, the only person to provide me with any sort of human touch or comfort was a best friend I grew up with, who's a critical care pulmonologist who had been counseling me through the whole thing. He came out to give me a gloved and masked hug and have a catch with me in the park.
But you're saying that even in grief, you're not able to get together with any other loved ones just to deal with it together.
No, yeah, not at all. So I have three siblings, two elder brothers and an eldest sister, and we all haven't congregated. We conference call a lot in the last week, but yeah, we can't get together. Not yet.
Tell me what it was like, just going back, when you first found out that your mom had COVID-19.
It was very frustrating to hear, because, you know, my mother, I'm a little reluctant to mention this because I think people have a tendency to tune out when they hear that, oh, this person is old, or this person had, you know, underlying conditions. But my mother had some underlying conditions. You know, she had type 2 diabetes. She had a slightly compromised immune system. She had stents in her heart, some issues with her eyes, but she led a pretty decently active retired lifestyle. She's only 72. And so when she got infected, you know, you can only tell, as I'm sure a lot of people can relate, their parents, our parents' generation, they're stubborn, they don't listen. You can only say, please stay inside so much.
Right.
You know, when she got infected, it was very, you know, it was March 22nd. She had reported a dry cough out of nowhere. And what's, you know, the most highly frustrating thing is we can't really give a definitive source of her infection. You know, she still, you know, ended up, you know, sneaking out, going to the bank by herself. She went back to the grocery store. There's nothing we could do, you know. And sure enough, she got sick.
What was it like when she was in the hospital? How did that work? Because you weren't able to go and visit her?
Correct, yeah. So her conditions worsened, and after 11 days, you know, my mother didn't want to go to the hospital, but there came a point where we waited, and we told her, you know, you need to get help. And she didn't have, her boyfriend at the time also had told her that he wasn't going to come around anymore to help her, because he had to isolate, because he felt like he was getting sick. And I think she fell twice and realized that she had to get to the hospital. So an ambulance took her there on April 1st, and she was in the ER. Her oxygen levels weren't great. A day later, she got worse. They tried to give her, you know, they took her off the nasal cannula and, you know, extreme oxygen, and put her on a CPAP machine. And that seemed to have worked again for a day, until she descended and got worse and was intubated. And she was of mind to commit to intubating, which is something she had always said she never would want to do, to be hooked up to life support or a ventilator. But she, you know, did it for us, because we, you know, through the phone, were begging her to fight with everything that she had.
What were you able to say to her when you did talk to her?
We didn't really, it wasn't so much of a conversation as she couldn't breathe. We only got to really FaceTime with her once she was on the ventilator. You know, she slightly opened her eyes through tears. You know, I'm telling her how much I love her. And, you know, we were spoke to by a doctor, the lead pulmonologist of the hospital, who had said that, you know, I frankly don't think your mother's going to survive this. I just went into kind of scramble mode, and I reached out to experimental drug companies, just cold emailed them, and incredibly one of them responded and thought that my mother was a great candidate. And trying this whole time for hours to get in touch with the hospital to stay my mother's palliative care and keep her from being unhooked from life support, she died. And it's just devastating, because again, it's like, you think that, you know, we're capable of enacting change, or there's always some maneuver that you can make to outmaneuver something like this. But, you know, in the end, look, I know that it probably was a few days off in timeline anyway. It wasn't really a minute miss out, but,
No, you did everything you could, Daryl. I mean, when I hear you say that, it's very clear that you did everything you could to help her. And you ended up writing this post on Facebook, after she passed away, and you said, I could not hold her hand on her last day of life as she held my hand the first day of mine, which was such a touching thing to read, because it made clear just how close the two of you were.
Yeah. You know, she'll never walk me down the aisle. I'll never get to dance with her at my wedding. She'll never meet my kids. But yeah, it's to not be able to, I think that's maybe the most painful part, is imagining her having been in the hospital 11 days by herself, but to not have family by her side at the end of your life. It's crushing to me. It really breaks every cell in my body that I couldn't have been there. She didn't deserve that. Yeah.
Daryl, one of the things that you wrote about this, and I want to ask you about it, is you said that one of the most tragic things about this is you believe that your mother's death was preventable. What do you mean by that?
You know, I've always been very, I really never get political in my life. I keep quiet, and I'm very respectful of everyone's opinion, because, you know, they always say don't talk about what, you know, religion and politics, and, you know, I really do appreciate every human being and person and their perspective, but this was fully preventable. The amount of deaths that we've had to endure, the tens of thousands of deaths we've had to endure. Close your eyes for a moment. Picture your family. Now imagine them gasping for air, frenetically ambulanced to the hospital, and then dying with the electronic sound of their fading pulse as their only company. You know, my mother loved many things. She loved getting together with family and celebrating holidays. She loved eating pasta, and she loved watching TV, including the news. And when you have conservative media trickling down the lies, and you have mixed messages about whether this is less harmful than the flu, that the flu is more deadly than this coronavirus, and then 6 weeks later, it's all of a sudden, it's you turn your chip around and you're claiming you need to stay in and that this thing could really hurt you. It confuses people. You're supposed to trust what the president says to you. I never would have thought of my mother as an unsuspecting martyr, but that's exactly what you're making her, along with the tens of thousands of her faded but not forgotten peers. And with every passing day you don't right your presidency ship and handling of this catastrophe, you're creating thousands more, because the cause they unwittingly died for will undoubtedly be your removal from office. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. But if there's something that you want to say to everybody just about how you'd like your mom to be remembered.
My mother was extremely kind and generous person. She was predeceased by my father, who she had married in 1972. He passed away in 2011. My father also was a survivor of 9/11 and was in the first building that had got hit and escaped from the 34th floor to safety, thank God. He had passed away from lymphoma, and after my entire lifetime of struggling with Parkinson's. And my mother took that tragedy and kind of rose from it and became stronger and the major adhesive of our family and kept us together. And she spent 32 years working for the Hewlett-Widmer School District as a monitor and teacher's aide, bringing her beautiful, what cannot be described as anything else than beaming smile to the hallways, so that every student could feel a little more cheered up every day. I'm going to miss her dearly. So will my family, and so will our community.
Well, Daryl, I wish that we were in the same place, because I would love to just give you a huge hug right now. I'm sure this is so difficult. I thank you for coming on and telling us about your mom and the experience you went through. And hopefully it will make a difference so that not so many other people will have to do the same.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on.
My friend Daryl Dushner talking about his mother Annette, who died on Easter Sunday. We've got photos of them at hereandnow.org, and we end this segment with a song that was one of her favorites.
I love to be free to live my life the way.
And the stock market opened lower today as the price of oil continues to free fall. Here in the U.S., a barrel of West Texas Intermediate sank yesterday below zero for the first time in history to negative $37 a barrel. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. And Robin, first of all, let's talk about what it means to see oil actually negative dollars a barrel. Many of us have never seen this in our lifetime.
Yeah, if you cut away all the trading lingo esoterica, it means fundamentally that there's a panic in the market that is rapidly running out of space to store the stuff. It keeps gushing out to the tune of 100 million barrels a day globally. And if you look at the chief U.S. storage hub in Cushing, Oklahoma, the capacity there is 80 million barrels. It only has about, less than 2 days of American production left in terms of storage ability until it overflows. And overseas, there's no space left in the Caribbean and South American, in sub-Saharan Africa. I think I should have gone into the oil tanker business, Tanya.
How much of this is because people aren't driving anymore due to the coronavirus versus how much it is because of the price war we recall in Saudi Arabia and Russia that got into earlier this year and that overflow you're talking about?
I mean, this is truly demand destruction. Saudi Arabia and Russia and OPEC, they reluctantly came to production cuts recently. They don't even go into effect until next month. But on the demand side, you're seeing a pullback unlike anything we've seen in recent or even further back history. Far fewer trucks and cars on the road. The skies are kind of bereft of airplanes. And we haven't turned down the taps anywhere near where it's necessary to hit an equilibrium. I saw a stat that, the demand fall just for this month is three times what we're seeing the promised OPEC cuts as. So we got a lot more to cut.
You know what? According to a recent report from the Dallas Federal Reserve, $50 a barrel is the average break-even point for Texas producers specifically. Obviously, we're way below that now. Are there going to be a lot of defaults in the coming year from this industry?
I think there will. But if you look at this, what's really interesting is that these guys are much more resilient, or they really don't have a choice in terms of shutting down wells at this point. It's just proving harder and more painful to shut down these wells in the United States oil patch. The equipment, for one, is expensive to move and to mothball. The banks behind these wildcatting firms, they're demanding service on their heavy debt payments, so you don't exactly have autonomy to shut them off. And we know that if you do shut them off and prices shoot back up, you can't exactly turn them back on overnight. So for the time being, at least, they keep gushing.
You know what? In the past, of course, we've heard murmurs about oil and gas getting a bailout. Do you think that's even back on the table right now?
It's a strange beast that shows you how far the United States has come in kind of 12 years to be the world's leading, oil producer. You are going to see some sort of unanimity between Texas and Oklahoma and the White House that we have to help our domestic producers somehow. But the paradox is to help them, we have to hurt them in the meantime. We have to tell them all to shut down. And I'm just not so sure the public would be willing to chomp down on this broad bailout of the U.S. oil patch.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure at member station VPM. Robin, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
President Trump is promising to sign an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration to the United States. He says it would protect American jobs during the coronavirus outbreak. Now, tightening the country's borders has been a central theme of the Trump administration even before coronavirus, and obviously there is an election coming up in a little over 6 months. Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, and does this look to you like a president using a crisis to achieve a pre-existing political goal?
It does. The immigration restriction is something he's been very intent on doing from the time he announced his campaign. And right now he's introducing it at a moment that he sees his presidential power is grander than ever. And because of the connection of the movement of people to the pandemic, he has a path to claim this is what needs to be done.
Do you see him leveraging the crisis politically in other areas?
Oh, absolutely. I think you're going to see many moves in the coming months, certainly to provide more relief to business, possibly further tax cuts, and even certain kinds of deregulations that have been central to his economic agenda. I suspect that will be part of future stimulus bills as well.
So as you look back to how past presidencies have responded to crises in ways that have been criticized, first of all, what comes to mind?
Sure. In during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln famously suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which was very controversial at the time. Roger Taney opposed it at the time, and it remains part of the legacy that many criticize. Also, FDR during World War II famously set up internment camps for Japanese Americans shortly after Pearl Harbor, which was a very aggressive use of executive power in a way that violated civil liberties and became a model of what not to do for coming generations.
Are there models of what to do that come to mind of presidents that responded, took advantage of a crisis, and did something that people look back on and say, well, good for them?
Sure. After President Kennedy was assassinated and Lyndon Johnson became president, he famously made a speech telling Congress and the nation, let us continue. And the way in which he wanted to continue with Kennedy's legacy was to push the Civil Rights Bill through Congress. And he tried to use that moment of crisis, the moment of trauma when people were still mourning Kennedy, to get through one of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation in American history. Many would say that President Obama did this too in the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. He used that moment to push for a massive expansion of health care with the Affordable Care Act. So we do look back to some of these times when presidents seize a crisis for other initiatives in good ways as well.
I want to ask you about something else. In a tweet last night, making the announcement about the immigration ban, President Trump called the virus something he's called it before, an invisible enemy. What does that bring to mind for you?
Yeah, it's a controversial term in two ways. One, it's a term often used in nativist circles and even anti-Semitic circles. It's a trope that has been invoked in bad ways to talk about secret enemies who are threatening us. We don't know what his intention was, but that's why the rhetoric is very loaded. It's also a way to kind of give up culpability. If an enemy is invisible, that means the president can't really see it. And so it's not the president's fault that this is causing such havoc. So in both senses, it's a pretty controversial term to use. And I'd conclude this isn't an invisible enemy. That's kind of the point of calling for massive testing. It can be found. And I think that's what his critics are talking about right now.
Julian, as you think about this crisis big picture, and there's so much that we don't know, and we don't know what's going to happen or how long this is going to last, but already it really does feel like a defining moment, one that we'll say pre-COVID, post-COVID, when we look back on this. What's your sense of how monumental this is in American history? Is it as big as World War II?
Oh, it is. I think the traumatic impact it's going to have on all of us, including younger children going through this, it won't be forgotten. This will be part of the memory bank and part of the fear that everyone will have from this point on of how the bottom can fall out and what a pandemic actually means. And there'll also be ongoing pain in the next few years to come because we can't go right back to normal. So we will literally be living with this even as things get better and even as we resume our lives. And we're going to have to work hard not only to repair the economy and make sure this doesn't happen again, but to fix all these social institutions from churches to schools that have been hurt, upset, and frayed as a result of what we're going through.
That's Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Julian, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, college students may not be on campus, but many are still hard at work as they finish out the spring semester, and some students in rural areas are dealing with an extra hurdle, lack of internet access. Liz Schlemmer of member station WUNC reports.
College sophomore Ty Meyer has been spending lots of time in parking lots lately, mostly at McDonald's or his local library. Those are often his best options for accessing Wi-Fi to turn in homework, including video assignments.
I record a 2-minute class video that takes an hour and a half to upload. I laugh when my friends are like, oh yeah, we got it knocked out within like 5 to 10 minutes.
What Meyer is describing is known as the homework gap, the inequality between students who have reliable internet and those who don't. The Federal Communications Commission estimates about 20 million Americans lack access to broadband internet. With many people going to school online and working remotely, those like Meyer are really struggling.
So for me, it's like, can you push through these last couple of weeks and kind of get there?
He says it's just frustrating that what's slowing him down is simply where he lives. When North Carolina State University asked students to continue class online, Meyer went home to his family's turkey farm in rural Piney Grove, North Carolina. His issue is not that his family can't afford a typical bill for broadband, but rather the internet companies say they can't afford to install broadband on his road.
They say it's not profitable. I guess even though I live on a 5-mile completely paved road that is literally only 2 turns right off I-40, but they say it's still too rural.
Meyer has friends just 10 miles away who have broadband, but his family's farm is in a dead zone. So his family of 6 shares internet from a hotspot. With 3 full-time students at home, they burn through their monthly limit quickly.
We have a solid week where we'll have internet just as good as anyone around, but really after we hit that cap, for the next 3 to 4 weeks, it's kind of struggling through.
Then their internet slows to a crawl. No uploading, downloading, or streaming. They could buy more high-speed access in small units, but the cost is too prohibitive. Leslie Boney is the vice provost for outreach and engagement at NC State. His team has been calling students in the 20 North Carolina counties with the lowest rates of broadband adoption.
We identified 720 students that we had in those areas to follow up with every one of those students that didn't currently have either a device, a camera or microphone, or internet access.
The university can fix some problems by mailing students a device, but in Meyer's case, the best advice they have is where to find a public place with Wi-Fi.
The reality is that the remainder of this semester is going to be a bridge temporary solution.
He and Meyer say they want to get this message to lawmakers, that now's the time to treat the internet like a public utility and bring it to rural communities the way the government helped string electric lines to the countryside in the 1930s. Jonathan Spalter is the president of U.S. Telecom, a national trade association for broadband internet providers. He says people may not realize it, but broadband installation looks a lot like those power lines.
99% of an internet connection actually is strung up on poles or is actually buried underground in fiber. It's very expensive and it can be very challenging to actually deliver, particularly to the most rural ranches and farms and communities.
The industry is working with Congress and state governments on public-private partnerships to help subsidize those costs and map out exactly where the needs are.
The great challenge that we have in the United States, and it's almost unique in any developed country, is the sheer vastness of the rural landmass. The job really is not going to get done until every single American is connected, regardless of what zip code they're in.
With that prospect still off on the horizon, Ty Meyer and other rural students will have to figure out ways to do their homework for the rest of the semester. For Here and Now, I'm Liz Schlemmer.
Demand for Uber and Lyft rides has plummeted during this COVID-19 pandemic. In an attempt to make up for lost revenue, Uber has expanded into package delivery and doubled down on its food delivery service. But it won't be enough to cover the shortfall. For more, we're joined now by Jessica Lesson. She's editor-in-chief of The Information. And Jessica, during a call with investors last month, Uber CEO said business was down 60 to 70% in Seattle because of this pandemic. Is it that bad everywhere?
So our reporters at The Information are hearing that, you know, it is down by about 50 plus percent across the board, and very similar situation for Lyft. Obviously, people are sheltering in place, and Uber's even running some TV ads telling people to stay home. So it has been deeply, deeply dramatic for the company, for sure. And really with no immediate end in sight.
Yeah, they've been trying lots of different things. So Uber's food delivery service, Uber Eats, is actually seeing a little bit of an uptick in business as people are taking they're ordering takeout. How much is this making up for this lost revenue?
It's really just a sliver in terms of what it makes up. The relative sizes of the business and their economics mean that, you know, while it's great that business is growing for Uber Eats, and we hear it's really growing, you know, by as much as 10% per week, which it is a large amount. It just doesn't make up. It's a fraction of the core business, and the economics are different in terms of how profitable it is to Uber. So we could see that it does shift even more consumers towards Uber Eats post-pandemic, and that would certainly be a good thing for the business overall. But in terms of near-term hit, it's still quite sizable.
Yeah, Uber is also getting in on other services like pharmacy deliveries. Thinking to the future and how this may offset some of the losses that they're saying, how is this going to work? And do you feel like it's going to make up for the shortfall?
It's fascinating because Uber actually dusted off an old service called Uber Rush that lets any business tap into its driver network to deliver goods. So it's cool to see a company kind of take an old product off the shelf and repurpose it. But I think demand and usage is just very small, and it's not, you know, creating enough demand too for drivers, who there's still many, many drivers on, you know, on the sidelines. And Uber lobbied to have gig workers like its drivers included in the CARES Act. So there will be some relief for them there. But I think that's one aspect to this that, you know, is pretty devastating. And these ancillary services really aren't anywhere near the volumes that would give work to all its drivers.
Yeah, so some relief for those drivers under the CARES Act, but are the companies also providing any additional support for its employees?
It is. You know, it's announced a variety of things. I think, you know, some of it is on the realm of sort of sick pay and as well as PPE for those who are able to work and out and about. You know, we've seen that some drivers have put barriers, plastic barriers, yep, between them and their passengers. And we also saw this in China quite a bit with Didi, the leading ride-hailing app out there. So I think the company has certainly been very active during this period. It's just, of all the kind of industries hit, it's really up there in terms of the impact.
Yeah, so taking a step back, really, and looking at the overall impact, you know, we've been talking for several years about these companies losing money. We were talking last year about Uber losing more than $8 billion and Lyft more than $2.5 billion. The bigger question is, can they really survive this? Or really, like to what you were saying earlier, will this reshape the ride-hailing industry?
I do think Uber is probably well-positioned to kind of emerge from the other side. I mean, it's interesting, actually. Part of the drain on Uber's business has been subsidies to recruit and attract drivers. That goes away because all of a sudden got a very eager-to-work workforce. So there's clearly a path for Uber emerging on the other side. In Lyft's case, you know, it's in a much rougher shape as a business. It's much smaller. The company doesn't have the multiple revenue streams like food delivery that Uber does. You know, I think it's more of an open question with Lyft. I wouldn't be shocked to, you know, see it maybe as an acquisition target post this if it couldn't totally get back on its feet. The tough thing is both of these companies were making big strides towards becoming more profitable in recent years after they went public. You know, investors wanted that loud and clear, and they were making big progress. So, you know, I think it's hard to tell, but I don't think either of these companies will ever be the same.
That's Jessica Lessen, editor-in-chief of The Information. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.